Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, good friends. Good to see you again. And welcome back to the Bill Press Pod. And welcome especially to this week's Reporters Roundtable, looking back at the big news of the week from our nation's capital. It's been a busy week on several fronts. Joe Biden released a bold new budget aimed at saving Social Security and Medicare, increasing funding for the military, and paying down the national debt by raising taxes on the wealthiest of Americans. But like most presidential budgets, it looks like it's dead on arrival in Congress. So what will Republicans propose instead? In other news, top Republicans and Democrats and Capitol Hill police all agree on one thing. The videos shown by Tucker Carlson do not reflect what really happened on January 6th. Three senators, Dianne Feinstein, John Fetterman, and Mitch McConnell, have all, two of them still in the hospital. Dianne Feinstein just released from the hospital. Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis both head to Iowa. And a little breaking news, New York Manhattan prosecutors inform Donald Trump's attorneys that he could be indicted as early as next week for hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. Whoa. Here to make some sense of it all, Sabrina Siddiqui, White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Hi, Sabrina.
Hi. Good to be here.
David, thank you. David Jackson, national political correspondent for USA Today. Hi, David.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And SV Day, White House correspondent for HuffPost. Hello, Sharish.
Hey, Bill.
So, before we get into all the news of the week, this is the first time that we've been able to welcome Sabrina Siddiqui back to the Bill Press Pod since she was one of only two reporters to accompany President Biden to Kyiv on that secret mission to Kyiv on February 20. Sabrina, first of all, great and gripping pool reports from that trip once you were able to report on it. I want to ask a little bit about it and get David and Sharish to comment also. But did you have any clue when they summoned you to the White House that you were heading to Ukraine?
I was suspicious about the nature of the meeting, and they had asked if I had a second passport. So I'm thinking, uh-oh, where are we going? But I did not anticipate that the meeting would be to say that I'd be one of just two journalists to go to Ukraine with the president, that we'd be leaving the next day. You know, I was scheduled to go to Poland with President Biden on that Monday, President's Day. And I just thought maybe what this meeting will be about is, okay, instead of going to Warsaw, maybe we'll arrive in Poland and make a quick trip to Ukraine, the entire press pool or something like that, as part of that trip. So I really did not by any measure anticipate what actually was about to unfold.
What was the most memorable moment? The train ride?
So I would say the train ride definitely was very surreal and bizarre, just because for any sitting president to spend 20 hours on a train is extraordinary, 10 hours each way. I mean, they don't even let President Biden take Amtrak. We all know how badly he wanted to take Amtrak. He wanted to come by Amtrak for his inauguration from Delaware, and they said no because it's too much of a security risk. He wants to do it for infrastructure, this infrastructure tour, and they haven't allowed him to. So it was just pretty extraordinary. But I think, being at Mariinsky Palace, the ceremonial home of President Zelensky and Ukrainian president in general, just a year prior to that, Russian propaganda had said, as the tanks were kind of encircling, that Zelensky had fled the capital city. And that was false. It was Russian propaganda. And Zelensky stood outside and recorded that famous iconic video right outside the palace saying, "I'm here," and basically calling Ukrainians to arms and to fight and defend their country. So then 1 year later, to be standing at that palace, and there's President Zelensky walking the halls with President Biden, and then his in this historic visit, I think that really hit as very, very symbolic and something that, of course, you know, it was an opportunity for me to really witness history firsthand.
Did you ever feel that you were in physical danger?
I think that the train ride was probably the most nerve-wracking on the way in, because it was entirely by night. We crossed the border within an hour from Poland into Ukraine. And so actually the vast majority, like 9 hours of that train ride, were in Ukraine in the middle of the night. And, you know, there were moments when we would stop, and at least one time it was to pick up more security. And I mean, you just aren't entirely sure when you're stopped, what's going on. And I think there is this vulnerability when you're on that train, just in case there's, you know, it wouldn't necessarily even be obviously intentional. There's, you know, you don't really know the nature of what could happen. That was the only time that you just felt more vulnerable. You know, when the air raid sirens are going off in Kyiv, that was a moment where you remember that you are in the capital city of a country that's at war. But there was a local reporter there who told me, you know, look, like, not, I don't know if it was, you know, it may not seem reassuring, but, you know, these actually go off all the time.
Oh yeah,
that, you know, they are used to it over there. So, you know, I think overall, you do remember that you are traveling with the President of the United States. It's the safest possible way to travel. But of course, that doesn't take away from the fact that this was a very risky trip for any president to take. And so, of course, there are moments where you did feel vulnerable, and that's part of the history there too.
So, David, we've seen other presidents visit war zones, but this is unlike any other presidential visit to a war zone, wasn't it?
Very much so. Because the Russians have actually bombed, you know, Kyiv, and it was very risky. I was quite shocked that he did it. Although I also feel like that these secret presidential trips have become something of a tradition, because all of our recent presidents have done them. I think starting with George W. Bush when he made his Thanksgiving Day trip to Iraq to meet with the troops, and that was held under very grave secrecy. And I guess that was dangerous. You know, Cheney was also in Iraq once, and the military base, there was a bombing incident near there. But yeah, it was extraordinary. And it was probably the most, to me, it was this Biden trip to Kyiv was probably the most surprising one and the riskiest.
Yeah, because in those other countries, you mentioned Iraq or Afghanistan, the United States military, right, was there.
Right.
There were military zones occupied by the U.S. military. Not in Ukraine.
No.
Yeah.
And the idea of taking a train, it's a 9-hour train ride in Ukraine while it's the subject of an invasion. It's really quite extraordinary. I mean, just think you could have a miscalculation from the Russian military, or anything could have happened to him. So, like I say, I found it extraordinary.
You know, SV, the other thing I found extraordinary is that the White House was able to keep this a secret for so long. When did you and other members of the White House press corps discover that the president wasn't even in the White House? He was on his way to Poland or Ukraine.
Right. Well, when I got Sabrina's first pool report, to be honest. I mean,
yeah,
they did a very good job. It's actually, if you're joining a trip like this with one that's already pre-scheduled, that isn't that hard. It's harder to pull off one where, you know, for example, when Trump was playing golf, which he pretty much did every day for it when he was down in Mar-a-Lago, I remember that's where they left from on his trip to, I think it was Iraq. But in any event, when I saw Sabrina's pool report, that was just stunning to me because, you know, as David pointed out, I mean, 9 hours on a train going 60 or 80 or 100 miles an hour or whatever over the ground in a country that's being bombed everywhere, you know, by Russia. Was a hell of a thing. I mean, they did tell us there was a conference call with the national security folks within an hour or two of them releasing that embargo. And they said, yeah, we gave the Russians a heads up. So I'm sure that probably played into, you know, a little bit better security, because I don't think that the Russian military really wants a major war with NATO or the United States or anything like that. But still, I mean, the risks involved, you know, and then the images were stunning. I mean, it just sent a huge message, which I thought was very powerful.
All right, so let's get back to the news here and the breaking news that we just heard last night. It's on the front page of the New York Times this morning. Is the Manhattan District Attorney has invited former President Donald Trump to testify in front of the grand jury next week on charges that he paid hush money to porn star Stormy Daniels. Sabrina, how serious is this?
Well, it's very serious, and it obviously would be unprecedented. Obviously, we're talking about a former president who is also a current presidential candidate. And I think with the hush money payments, though, that has been one of the Trump investigations where prosecutors have felt there is the most evidence directly implicating former President Trump. I mean, Michael Cohen, his former personal attorney, did testify under oath that he was directed to make those payments by Trump himself. And there's evidence that the Trump organization falsified business records related to those payments. So I think that the question, of course, is what happens next? There's an offer to Trump to testify next week before a grand jury, which has been hearing evidence in this case, or potential case. That usually signals that an indictment is close. Prosecutors don't typically notify a possible defendant if they're not ultimately seeking charges. Does he testify or not? It's obviously always been seen as a liability for Trump to testify because, to put it mildly, he has a problem with telling the truth. And, I think then the question would be, would he actually face criminal charges? Because there's going to be a lot of questions around, I think, still whether he would ultimately be convicted. And this is a very complex case. And there is that question mark around him being a former president, even though that doesn't mean he's above the law.
Right.
But some reticence around this uncharted path.
Attorneys, legal experts say today would be very unusual for the district attorney to invite someone to testify without actually filing charges. That it looks like it's already in the books. Were he indicted, David, would it make any difference in his 2024 plans?
I can't help but think yes.
You think yes, right?
Yeah. Well, his base would rally around him, so that's one thing that would happen. But I think people in the middle would be moderate, and I would think that Republicans who are kind of tired of Trump, it would give them one more excuse to look at someone else. But I also say I think this is going to be a strange case because what Cohen talked about it was violations of federal campaign finance law.
Right.
This is a state grand jury. So I had a lawyer talk to me last night who thinks that he could actually be indicted on a misdemeanor in New York. And that the felony count would be an attempt to say that that Trump did this in order to violate federal law. Like this, he took this action in order to avoid federal law. And that's going to be a tricky case to make in a state court, and I think it's going to confuse a lot of people. It's confusing me, and I think I tell people all the time: be careful what you wish for when you want to see Trump indicted, because these cases these cases could be very difficult, and they could wind up backfiring on the prosecutors.
Right. And SV President Trump, to no one's surprise, put out a statement last night denying any payment. He also said, quote, "I never had an affair with Stormy Daniels, nor would I have wanted to have an affair with Stormy Daniels." So clearly he's going to fight this, unlike Richard Nixon, maybe, who didn't fight the Watergate charges. He's going to fight this.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, in my mind, this one was always puzzling when Bragg, it seemed like Bragg was putting some energy back into this. When the Southern District of New York had let it go at Cohen and not tried to go after Trump, of course, Trump at that time was the sitting president. So that made a difference. Donald Trump used the threat of violence and violence itself eventually to try to hang on to power despite losing election. That's the definition of a self-coup, right? So what he did with the porn star, how much he paid her and things, I feel like even in 2016, voters kind of knew that, hey, this guy does these kind of things. And they voted for him anyway. He hadn't done a coup, right, in 2016, and he hadn't done a coup in 2020 heading into that election. And it seems that for the sake of democracy, those are the important charges, the ones in Georgia and the ones coming out possibly out of DOJ in D.C. And I feel almost like Alvin Bragg, after kind of putting the brakes on or maybe even ending that initial investigation into the tax records and so on, kind of said, hey, wait a minute, these other people are going to indict him? He's from New York, I should indict him. And then jumped into it, and yeah, into this other thing that was still hanging out there. But as David said, this is a state charge on what's basically a federal campaign finance thing. I'm sure there are, I know there are laws against fraud and conspiracy to commit fraud in New York state. It's been a long time since I covered the criminal courts in New York state. But there's always a way you can find a conspiracy, you know, if two or more people are talking about doing crimes, and I'm sure they could do that. It does seem kind of a distraction from the big deal, which is that he did a very bad thing leading into January 6th, and we ought not forget it.
Right. Yeah. So just summing up, if he is indicted there, it certainly will not be the last time, because we still have Georgia and the Department of Justice investigations underway, of course. And most of the news this week in Washington, D.C. was about Tucker Carlson and his show, where he played some video, the first little selected videos that he picked out of the 41,000 hours of video he was given of January 6th by Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Clearly, Sabrina, the tapes that Tucker Carlson showed, which he described as showing nothing but basically a tourist visit by Trump supporters to the U.S. Capitol, or he called it peaceful chaos. We have to agree, they do not represent what happened on January 6th. Why show those videos, Sabrina?
Well, this is just another effort by Tucker Carlson to misrepresent what actually happened on January 6th. And that was exactly why House Speaker Kevin McCarthy faced so much criticism for handing the tapes over to Tucker Carlson in the first place, because he has used his primetime show to spread misinformation about the insurrection and to downplay what actually happened, which, you know, was not, you know, just an effort to overturn an election, but a violent riot where 138 police officers were injured. Five people died, you know, either shortly before, during the event or following the event. You had four officers who responded to the attack who died by suicide within 7 months. So we already, you know, most people, of course, are well aware of what actually transpired that day, but it still remains this polarizing issue for the Republican base, where they feel that it was misrepresented. And Tucker Carlson is playing right into those conspiracy theories as there's another election around the corner. It's interesting, though, that led to this split between McConnell and McCarthy. McConnell criticizing Tucker Carlson and Fox News for its portrayal of January 6th. He didn't directly criticize McCarthy and the decision to hand over the tapes, but we all know how McConnell works.
Yeah.
The criticism of Fox News and Tucker Carlson's representation of those tapes is an implicit criticism of McCarthy for handing the tapes over in the first place.
Yeah. So, David, to Sabrina's point, it does kind of put the Republicans in a pickle, doesn't it, that they're kind of forced now to defend what happened on January 6th, and some of the Republicans are not ready to go there, as Sabrina pointed out. Let's listen here back to back. First of all, Senator Tom Tillis from North Carolina, and then Leader Mitch McConnell.
I think it's bullshit. I was here. I was down there. And I saw maybe a few tourists, a few people who got caught up in things. But when you see police barricades breached, when you see police officers assaulted, all of that, or you had to be in close proximity to it, I just don't think it's helpful.
With regard to the presentation on Fox News last night, I want to associate myself entirely with the opinion of the chief of the Capitol Police about what happened.
So, David, where do Republicans go on this, right?
Well, they need to go follow McConnell and Tillis, and January 6th is a problem for the Republican Party, and the sooner they own up to it and disassociate themselves from it, I think the better off they'll be. In terms of the Carlson contingent that wants to try to explain it away or suggest some kind of conspiracy, that's just simply a political loser. I really don't understand why they're pursuing it the way they are, but they're not going to change anybody's mind with this kind of thing. All they're going to do, they're going to reinforce their own base's suspicions about what happened, but they're not going to change anybody else's mind. I think it's just a horrible mistake. In terms of politics, I think it's just a horrible mistake from Carlson and Jim Jordan and all the rest.
So a lot of the criticism, of course, is directed correctly at Tucker Carlson, who cherry-picked the videos that he wants to show and has been trying to downplay what happened on January 6th from the very beginning. But SV, the person who gave him the tapes, was the Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy. Here is Congressman Eric Swalwell, who says, let's not forget who's ultimately responsible.
I think it's important that we keep the focus on Kevin McCarthy here, right? When you go to the zoo and there's a sign that says, you know, don't feed the animals, it's because the animals can't help themselves, right? Tucker Carlson, he can't help himself, but us humans, we can. And so Kevin McCarthy is the one who has, you know, fed the trolls, so to speak. And so the responsibility, you know, should lie at his feet.
Does he have a point there, SV?
Are the Republican leadership of the Congress responsible? Hell yeah. I mean, let's not forget here. Number one, Kevin McCarthy was mad that people broke into the Capitol and nearly got him killed. I mean, he was angry. He was trying to call Donald Trump that day.
Well, for a little while he was. Right?
For that day and maybe for the next day. But within 3 weeks, he went down to Mar-a-Lago, had that picture taken with the former president. And let's also not forget that Mitch McConnell had the ability to end Donald Trump's political career, his ability to run for anything in the United States ever, had he gone along with the conviction and brought 11 others with him. Easily possible. He still is a Republican leader. He could have made that happen, and we wouldn't be having this, as many discussions about Donald Trump as we are today. So this is squarely at the feet of McConnell. McConnell, I think. And then after he failed to do what he needed to do, then McCarthy. So in terms of Tucker Carlson, yeah, but you know what? Tucker Carlson doesn't hire himself. I mean, he broadcasts on this network that let's not forget where that came from. There was a guy who worked in Richard Nixon's White House named Roger Ailes, who wanted to create a little news service back in 1973 that would put pro-Nixon video in the hands of local stations all over the country to get their view out, so to preempt basically the national network's news about how bad Watergate was. That never happened, but then he went on to create Fox News in the mid-90s for the purpose, specific purpose of exactly what Tucker Carlson is doing, which is like propagandizing things that are really on their face ridiculous, but you know, Fox News, that's where the money is. And so, you know, we talk about how the base feels this and they feel they need to. Well, why does the base feel that? Why? Right? If everybody, including Fox, had just said, no, Donald Trump is straight up lying, he didn't win the election, there was no fraud, the base wouldn't feel that. The base would be mad that they lost, but they would get over it. But this is ridiculous now, this chicken and egg question of, well, you know, we have to say this because that's what our voters think. Well, you know, why do you suppose they think that? Had there been unanimity among Republicans and among conservative media that this was all nonsense and was corrosive to democracy, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Got it. By the way, Eric Swalwell, we just heard there, will be our next guest on the Bill Press Pod coming up next Tuesday, and we'll get more of his take on what Kevin McCarthy is up to and also about his exile from the House Intelligence Committee at the orders of Kevin McCarthy. Wow, good start, but a lot more to talk about here, a lot more happening this week. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll be back with today's panel, Sabrina Siddiqui, David Jackson, and SV Date, all here on the Bill Press Pod and today's roundtable. And today's Reporters Roundtable on the Bill Press Pod brought to you by the Smart Union, the good men and women of the Smart Union. That's the union that was formed when they put the sheet metal workers together with air, rail, and transportation workers, forming the Smart Union under the leadership of President Joseph Sellers. Under the Infrastructure and the Inflation Reduction Act, members of the Smart Union rebuilding America's infrastructure. We salute the good members of the Smart Union, thank them for their great work rebuilding America, and thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod. Check out their website at smart-union.org.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we're back with today's Reporters Roundtable here on the Bill Press Pod. Joining us, Svidate, who is the White House correspondent for HuffPost, David Jackson, national political correspondent for USA Today, and Sabrina Siddiqui, White House reporter for the Wall Street Journal. President Biden going up to Philadelphia yesterday to unveil his pretty bold and expansive $6.8 billion budget. So David Jackson, like any presidential budget, this doesn't necessarily mean that what he proposes is what's going to happen, right?
No, not even close in this case. It's all, yeah. I mean, it's, I hate to say it, but it's even more of a sideshow this year than it has been because of the standoff over the debt ceiling. I mean, that's the real fiscal issue that everyone's concerned about, whether the Republicans will stick to their threat to not raise the debt ceiling and perhaps trigger a government default. Now Biden's put on a plan to try to pressure them politically, but we don't know if it'll work, and it'll be weeks before we find out. But yeah, it's a cliche, but it's true. Biden's budget is DOA, dead on arrival.
So Sabrina, is what the president really doing, kind of laying out his campaign platform for 2024?
Absolutely, and I think in general we've seen that budgets put out by the White House are more of a blueprint for policy priorities than they really are any realistic text that's going to become law. So with Biden, you're seeing, you know, fairly progressive budget proposal, proposing tax increases on the wealthy and corporations, to offset both domestic spending as well as to reduce the deficit, the White House says. And, you know, to David's point, this is dead on arrival in a Republican-led House. So really it sets the contours of the debate that will take place, not just in these spending battles that he mentioned, like the debt ceiling this year, but in a 2024 campaign cycle where I think you'll see Biden, if he runs, which he's expected to do, and Democrats revive these themes that they have often gone back to in previous elections, that Republicans are pushing policies that are geared toward benefiting the rich and a minor, you know, small percentage of the population, that Democrats are champions of middle and working class Americans, as well as to kind of create set up the debate over entitlement programs as well, which is a key part of this budget. The White House says these tax increases on the wealthy are also necessary to preserve the solvency of Medicare, Social Security. And we saw Biden challenge Republicans at the State of the Union to, you know, to call, basically ensuring that they would commit to not making any cuts to entitlement programs. So those are some of the themes that I think will be integral, not just to the fight that you'll see between the White House and Republicans on Capitol Hill, but also in this widely anticipated Biden reelection campaign.
And so the president realizes that, with Republicans, particularly in control of the House, it's going to have to take a lot of negotiation and maybe even some compromise. Yesterday in Philadelphia, he said, okay, I'm ready to sit down anytime. Here's the president.
So I want to make it clear, I'm ready to meet with the speaker anytime, tomorrow, if he has his budget. Lay it down. Tell me what you want to do. I'll show you what I want to do. See what we can agree on. If we don't agree on, let's fight it out in the Congress.
So, SV, do we know what the Republicans want to do? Isn't that the president's point, that he's come up with a plan and they don't have one?
Right. And they won't have a real plan. And you know, this brings back when I used to, I was a congressional editor at NPR, and every year we'd very dutifully do stories about there's the president's budget, and now the Congress will produce its budget. But remember, the budget is not really a budget. It's just a blueprint, because it's really the appropriations bills that are the real budget. And, you know, thank God I don't have to do that stuff anymore, because what's going to happen is in like mid to late September, there's going to be a CR that'll get it by for another few weeks or months. And then there'll be a final CR for the year long. Come on. I mean, this is, you really don't want to cut Social Security and Medicare, do you? And the Republicans say, no, of course we don't. So we'll put up a budget and they'll cut everything else by 90%. That's the only way you can make it actually balance. What we're seeing here is a basically just an experimental test of modern monetary theory, I think, that, hey, you know what, if you're the reserve currency, you prove that deficits don't matter and debt doesn't matter, which is what actually Dick Cheney said, what, in 2002 or one, that this is all nonsense and it doesn't matter, and so don't worry about it. And you know what, most of America doesn't. So I guess we'll see if one day we actually do crash the world economy and we're like Greece, I guess we're all wrong. But until then, we'll keep going, and the Federal Reserve will try to keep inflation from getting too high and interest rates from getting out of hand and try to balance that. And I look forward to the CR in September.
By the way, just a final point on this. When the Republicans saying that they want to balance the budget, but they don't want to cut Social Security, they don't want to cut Medicare, and they don't want to cut defense spending, the New York Times yesterday had a chart of everything that would have to be cut if you leave those three parts of the federal government intact. It'll blow your mind. I encourage you to pull that out and check it out. Well, let's get right down and dirty to politics today. Ron DeSantis has been out there with his new book, traveling around the country, and today he goes to Iowa. Is this the Republican lineup for 2024, David? This head to head between Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis?
Well, yeah, those two and Nikki Haley, at least.
True.
I'm just struck by the fact that our old friend Tim Scott is hiring people left and right for what looks like he's going to be a presidential campaign on his own.
Whoa. Uh-huh.
So this will be a first, guys. We'll have four candidates, and we'll have two candidates from the same state. Two states. That's never happened before. Got two guys from Florida, and we have two people from South Carolina. So it's kind of unique. But I think most of the attention will be on Trump versus DeSantis, and I think this will be the first round, these trips to Iowa. DeSantis is going on the day that we've taped this podcast, and Trump is going on Monday. So it'll be interesting to see. A lot of people will be watching to see how each of them handles it.
You don't think there'll be any more? Do you think this is the four of them?
I'm starting to think Scott will run. I'm less certain about Mike Pompeo, although I guess he'll run. He's done everything that you need to do. And Mike Pence is also very much a question mark to me because he's going to get jammed up in this January 6th investigation. I'm pretty sure the courts are going to make him testify against Trump, and that's not going to go down well with Trump or any of his supporters. So I kind of wonder if Pence is having second thoughts about running for president. But I'm not sure I can see anybody out there. Like Asa Hutchinson may also run, but who cares? I think it's really going to boil down to Trump and DeSantis, and maybe with Nikki Haley pulling 5-7% and affecting what happens between those other two.
Sabrina, we've seen Ron DeSantis now. Certainly, we've seen him in Florida for the last few years, and we've seen him a little bit on the national platform. How's he? Generally, how would you rate his? Is he ready for prime time? Does he look like a serious presidential candidate?
I think so. And, you know, I think, well, this is going to be the challenge for Democrats. It's going to be very similar to Glenn Youngkin's campaign.
Good point.
In the Virginia gubernatorial race, where Ron DeSantis has effectively been willing to ride whichever wave will get him, you know, elected at the next level. And so if it meant embracing the Tea Party in one moment, he's there. If it's, you know, just going full Trump as he did in the primaries when he ran for governor, infamous campaign ad teaching his daughter, his toddler, to build a wall with blocks, he'll do it. Then, you know, when he's in, you know, this position where a statewide position where you have to sort of be a little bit more amenable to the broader public, on willing to kind of cast himself as a little bit more of an establishment figure, whatever that means in the current day Republican Party. But make no mistake, he's also been right at the forefront of these culture wars, advancing anti-LGBTQ legislation. Of course, was, you know, really one of the faces of, against COVID restrictions at the height of the pandemic. So, you know, I think it really is wherever the political winds take him within the Republican Party and where he feels the base is at in that moment. But someone that I think a lot of establishment people will still rally behind because they probably still see him as their best shot and best alternative to Trump, who I think, you know, at this point, many Republican leaders or elected officials would like to be done with if they can. Of course, again, that where Republican voters are is what will ultimately dictate this Trump-DeSantis matchup. But I think the thing about DeSantis is he is very much a chameleon. And so it will be very hard, I think, for Democrats to typecast him as, you know, another Trump or an extremist, because he is someone who could probably sell himself to many different types of voters.
And then, as both of you mentioned, there is Nikki Haley, the only one who's officially out there running for the nomination. She hasn't yet made it running against Donald Trump. So, Esty, here's Nikki Haley this week trying to make her play in prime time.
On Biden and Harris's watch, this woke self-loathing has swept our country. It's in the classroom, the boardroom, and the back rooms of government. We're told our country is flawed, rotten, and full of hate. Joe and Kamala even say that America's racist. Wokeness is a virus more dangerous than any pandemic, hands down.
There it is, SV. She's running against wokeness. Is she running for president or vice president?
Oh, she's running for president. I think, there are some people who know that they have absolutely zero chance of getting the nomination, and are in there for something else. I don't think she's one of them. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, she came from she was governor for a couple of terms. She was UN ambassador, which I of course is not the same as being Secretary of State, but it's not nothing. And so she's got a pretty decent resume for this run. Now, as to DeSantis, I mean, I spent most of my career in Florida. I was just down there for his State of the State speech, and it was interesting. He did not use the word woke once. Not once. And I was shocked. I actually made a tally on my notebook to keep track of how many instances there were so that I could divide it by the number of minutes of the speech. And the percentage was zero instances of woke. He didn't really get into details about anything. And he did not mention abortion. Now, there's a 6-week abortion ban coming up in the state legislature, which will pass. And then because of the primary, he will sign. And then he's in serious trouble in a general election because voters have made it very clear that they're not interested in restrictions that go that far. As to he and Trump, now, this is interesting because, voters are still enamored with Trump and the Republican side, but they're also sick of losing. They really are. I mean, the last three elections have been bad for Republicans, and the reason for that is one guy who lives down in Palm Beach and insults people. And they're done with it. And they would, if he's the best chance of winning, it'd be nice if people said, you know, he did a coup, so we shouldn't reward him, and he should be in prison and stuff. But they're not. They're done with him because he's a loser. He's a 3-time loser, and they don't want it to be a 4-time loser. So right now, it's all this DeSantis versus Trump. But things will change dramatically once he's indicted. You know, because as a former Trump administration official told me that most voters, even most Trump voters, are going to say, well, we can't nominate a guy who's indicted. We're not in New Jersey. And so I think that'll just put a different look on it. And if Trump is no longer the 900-pound gorilla, that opens up the race to all kinds of people. You know, we mentioned Scott. I mean, I think Glenn Youngkin can't run for reelection in Virginia. I think Chris Sununu is an interesting voice in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And hey, the one guy that I keep waiting for to jump in, because I think he already took on Trump and beat him, is Brian Kemp in Georgia.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he won a pretty substantial win in what was a hard-fought state. He could be the sleeper if people talk him into running.
All right. And we're just getting started. Just getting started in the 2024 race, but just ending up today's podcast. And a big thank you to our members of the roundtable today, Sabrina Siddiqui from the Wall Street Journal, David Jackson, USA Today, and SV Dottie from HuffPost. And my good friends, before you head off into the weekend, what was the one story that caught your attention this week above all others and made you sort of stop and either weep or laugh about it? David, start us off. Your favorite story of the week.
Not too much to laugh about these days. I guess I'll pick a series of stories, and it's it's one of the upcoming great events of any year, and it's the National College Basketball Tournament, which is going to get started next week. March Madness is upon us once again. And I really like it because, first of all, I started as a sports writer and I love the game. But also, it's one of the few institutions left in public life in which we can all agree that it's something worth watching. And Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, they all come together at March Madness to either fill out brackets or comment on social media on the teams. And it also kind of unifies the country. I mean, we'll have teams from Arizona, California, South Carolina, from all across the country. There'll be at least one team represented, and it's a lot of fun, and it'll be a nice respite from all this bad political news.
Remember Barack Obama filling out his bracket, right? When we were covering the White House.
He was always picking Kansas because he was from there, so I always accuse him of having a little bit of a bias there, but that's all part of it, too.
And Sharish, you at HuffPost, what caught your attention particularly?
What caught my attention was Sabrina's story about being a new mom, a nursing mom, having to go
on
a secret flight in the middle of the night and then on a long train ride into a war zone and the challenges that presented. You know, I can't even imagine being pool on that trip. I mean, I'm stressed out enough on normal travel pool days when I'm going to, like, Philadelphia for a speech or something, you know, because, it's all on you. I can't even... I can't even imagine the pressure of being on this trip and being me and just the AP photographer, and that's it. And then on top of that, having to make espresso and store milk. I mean, that's my hat's off to you, Sabrina. Well done.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And I'm so glad that that essay resonated with a lot of people. So
that was a beautiful story. I have to ask, can I ask a question, Sabrina?
Of course.
So you were pumping your breast milk and you said you were able to find people who would put it in the refrigerator for you, right?
Yes.
Did you bring that home to the United States?
Or what? I did. But one thing that I mentioned in this was, I was very lucky because I had these resources due to the method of travel here, and most women don't.
Yes.
And that was important for me to acknowledge too, that, we are just a striking lack of support and infrastructure for women when they return to work, and especially for breastfeeding and pumping moms. Now, I was in a situation where I could ask the flight attendants on Air Force One if they could keep the milk, and then the train attendant, if she could keep the milk. And eventually I just needed to get to Warsaw. Once you're in Warsaw, then most hotels, wherever you are willing to freeze your milk for you or put it in their fridge while you're there. And then it was just a question of getting it back to the U.S. But because I was flying, essentially in a private capacity, then, I had resources that many women don't, because TSA is obligated to allow you to carry your breast milk through security. But then keeping it stored on a commercial flight is a lot more challenging. And a lot of women just aren't able to and have to throw it out, which is just devastating. So I'm very fortunate, and I really hope one of the other conversations that may result from this is how to ensure that more women have the resources they need to succeed when they go back to work.
Well, it was a great story. Thank you for telling that story. And now, Sabrina, do you have a favorite dog story?
So I have to always bring something about dogs. That's just going to be my thing, right? So I actually found this, it's not even a story as much as a conversation starter in the Washington Post just the other day. And I think you guys should ask this question at your next social gatherings, because I think it's going to be one of those debates about, is it appropriate to recline the seat on the plane? Remember that debate?
Yes.
There's a question in the Washington Post: what are the responsibilities of dog owners when they're hosting? And, the question is, are you first obligated to your guests? And if they're not comfortable, like, with dogs, should you just assume they're not? And should you have the dog in its crate or in another room or outside? Or, it's your house, they've come over, and your dog is part of the family. And so just let the dog be natural in its habitat. And this is one of those very polarizing subjects that I'm fascinated by. And I think especially now that we have a baby, I personally love dogs. But of course, now that we have a baby, sometimes if someone's dog just rushes over and starts licking her face, it's not ideal. if no one asks, and I love dogs, everyone knows that. So, I think it's one of those that's actually, I find very interesting, looking at it through a different lens. And I would love it. I think this is one of those, because I saw there's many different ways in which people have responded to this question. It's triggered a lot of debate over at the Washington Post, and I bet if you guys bring this up at one of your next social gatherings with dog owners and non-dog owners, it would probably be one of those that touches a nerve or brings out a lot of interesting opinions.
All right. We will accept your challenge, Sabrina. I think a lot of it has to do on how well-behaved the dog is, but that's just a quick reaction on my part. And I have to tell you, my favorite moment of the week among many was last Monday in the White House briefing. We have not mentioned yet among presidential candidates, Marianne Williamson, whom I don't think should be mentioned or even taken seriously. But her name was raised at the White House briefing, and White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, I thought, responded in the best tone of all, where she just kind of made fun of the whole thing. Here is the press secretary.
Just not tracking that. I mean, if I had a little globe here, crystal ball, then I can tell you. But I imagine eight ball, whatever. If I could feel her aura, I just don't have anything. I just don't have anything to share on that.
Marianne Williamson was not happy with that response, but I identify with Karine Jean-Pierre. I cannot feel Marianne Williamson's aura either. I don't think most Americans can. And that's it for today's roundtable. Great big thank you to SV Date, White House correspondent for HuffPost, to David Jackson, national political correspondent for USA Today, and Sabrina Siddiqui, White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you, guys. And thank you all for joining us today. And again, we invite you back for the next edition of the Bill Press Pod next Tuesday, where we'll be talking with Congressman Eric Swalwell from California about what's happening, particularly on the Republican side of the Congress this year, but also how Hakeem Jeffries is doing as the new Democratic leader. All of that coming up next Tuesday. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Tuesday on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod with Eric Swalwell.